You may be seated. Imagine it's the first day of school. The teacher comes and says, here's our textbook, 300-page textbook. Turn to page 200. That's where we're going to begin our study. Well, you know, 2 Timothy 3:16 says all Scripture is given by inspiration of Yahweh. So we can't neglect any of it. We can't throw out the old, say we're only a New Testament group of believers, because there's so much to learn through the entire book. So much, so many lessons that we can gain and glean from in the walk of Israel and how they did and didn't succeed in many of the ways that they were called out of. I want to look at the book of Numbers today. Numbers bridges the gap from the time Israel received the law at Sinai to the time they entered into the Promised Land. Chronologically, it begins where Exodus leaves off and takes us to the book of Joshua or Joshua. And the book of Numbers has a number of amazing parallels with the book of Acts. I don't know if you ever looked at it that way, but you look at Numbers and you read how it details the walk of the newly called out believers, just as we find in the book of Acts. We find that in the book of Acts we have a walk of a new assembly called out by Yahshua the Messiah. In both books, through many examples, it shows how to live a scriptural life. Both books give us insight into the lives of various people of Yahweh. Both of them show the actions of apostates within that body, and both of them teach important lessons through various circumstances and incidences that occurred. I like to call the book of Numbers the Acts of Israel. It has three significant historical aspects to it. Of course, it has the law, the giving of the law, the beginning of it, the various acts of worship, including the consecration of the temple. It has Israel's leadership and the struggle that took place in leading Israel out of Egypt into the Promised Land. And it also prepares Israel for taking of the Promised Land. The boundaries are set, the final instructions are given, they're waiting to go in. And as it closes, Israel is poised to take possession of their inheritance. In Romans chapter 11, verse 22, Apostle Paul speaks about the goodness and the severity of Yahweh. To me, in a nutshell, that's what Numbers is all about. The goodness and the severity of Yahweh. The severity seen in the death of all those people who rebelled against him and would not let them into the Promised Land. And the goodness realized in that new generation. Yahweh protected and preserved and provided for these people until they could possess the land. No matter how strong the enemy, no matter how tough the journey, no matter how difficult their struggles, with Yahweh's help, anyone can overcome. And that's the lesson of this book. Truly trusting in Yahweh means obeying him when we don't understand completely, and yet having the faith to do it. Yahweh judges disobedience severely, but in judgment, he has mercy for those who are ignorant, simply don't know or understand. Today I want to look at two notable events in this book that hold, I believe, the most important lessons that we can learn today. And I chose them because they reflect the natural tendencies of our typical situation in which we live in this world. And certainly the tendencies that will pull at us in the days to come. It has been said that there's no truer measure of a man than what he does when the heat is on and nobody's watching. That's the true measure. In Numbers chapter 11, Israel was doing what people typically do when they lack the creature comforts of this world, and when they don't have the strong spiritual convictions to help them overcome. What did they do? Chapter 11, verse 1, and when the people complained, it displeased Yahweh. And Yahweh heard it, and his anger was kindled. They were complaining. They started complaining. They weren't happy. But indications are that they weren't just griping. The indications are they were going backward in heart. They were actually turning back. So Yahweh sent a rod of punishment. He sent fire. And the fire of Yahweh burnt among them and consumed them that were in the uttermost parts of the camp. And the people cried unto Moses. And when Moses prayed unto Yahweh, the fire was quenched. Yahweh says, you want to whine? I'll give you something to whine about. What was the problem? They weren't eating gourmet. That was the problem. Big deal. They were living on manna and longing for the old days when they had vegetables. Verse 5. We remember the fish, which we did eat in Egypt freely, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. But now our soul is dried away and there's nothing but this manna before our eyes. They added one more to their inventory of complaints. Now they weren't happy because they didn't have what they wanted to eat. There was a new visitor who came to the Feast of Tabernacles one year. And from the moment he arrived, he complained because there weren't enough free meals for him. Poor guy, he just came for the wrong reasons. If we can't give up some of those physical amenities to partake in the spiritual, we're not fit for the kingdom. If we constantly look back to the comforts of the sin we had, we're not fit for the kingdom. This is one of the lessons in Numbers. You know, food to some people is a big thing. They eat to, or actually they live to eat rather than eat to live. Israel's hearts weren't aimed on the heavenly, but they focused in the dirt. What grows in the dirt? Cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, all those things down in the ground. They weren't looking up high, focusing on Yahweh. Their minds were in the dirt, and they wanted all those good things that come out of the ground. They couldn't stomach the pure bread or manna that Yahweh gave them. They wanted a delectable mixture, and so it is today. So it is today. They can't accept the word as it is. They got to change it. They got to tweak it. They got to add to it or even give it up for nothing at all. The unadulterated word is not enough. Look at verse 8. The people went about and gathered the manna and ground it. Look how they had to change it and manipulate it and tweak it. They ground it in mills, they beat it in mortar, and baked it in pans, and made cakes of it, and the taste of it was the taste of fresh oil. Sounds good to me. It's like going out and getting pie crust, you know, with a sugary good taste. That's what it sounds like to me. I'd love to eat that all day long. But they didn't, and Moses is at wit's end. It got to the point, in verse 14, he says, I am unable to hear this people alone, because it is too heavy for me. The volatility of this whole situation has now reached critical mass. And Moses said, if I can't have some relief of some type, then just kill me, Yahweh. Just kill me. Just, I can't take it anymore. Frankly, I don't know how he lasted up this long. Imagine 2 to 3 million whiners. Imagine camping out with that many people that day after day they have nothing but complaints. This is a number of people that would fill like the city of Chicago. And all they can do is complain about everything. There you are, out in the wilderness, no comforts of home. You know, they had zero comforts as slaves, but they kind of forget that part. And that's the irony of it. Man has a short memory when he wants to. Children, elderly, livestock to take care of. They don't have running water. They're cold, they're hot, whatever it is, whatever the situation is, they're just not very happy, and Moses can't fix it. They had many trials, problems added to their routine because they're out, you know, not at home. We all know how it is to be away from home. And Moses is supposed to make it all go away, make the bad stuff disappear, solve all the petty problems of 2 to 3 million people. Well, Yahweh does realize that Moses can no longer handle it. Maybe he's just getting too old by this point. He just can't. Maybe he's just, you know, overload. So he says, choose 70 men. Choose 70 men in verse 17 to help. And I will come down and talk with you there, and I will take of the Spirit which is upon you and will put it upon them, and they shall bear the burden of the people with you, that you bear it not yourself alone. So Yahweh's going to take the Spirit from Moses and distribute it 70 different times on different men. And say unto the people, sanctify yourselves against tomorrow, and you shall eat flesh, for you have wept in the ears of Yahweh, saying, who shall give us flesh to eat? For it was well with us in Egypt, therefore Yahweh will give you flesh, and you shall eat. You're not going to eat just one day, nor 2 days, nor 5 days, neither 10 days, nor 20 days, but even a whole month until it comes out of your nostrils. And it be loathsome unto you. You're going to get just sick of it, because that you have despised Yahweh, who is among you, and have wept before him, saying, why came we forth out of Egypt? They just didn't get it, did they? Just didn't get the whole spiritual. They didn't get the whole concept of what this is all about. He says, okay, you're going to get meat, more meat. Besides that, then he sends a plague on them, even while they were eating. Many of them died. This is one reason I never try to complain about food. Anyway, there's a valuable lesson here. And this is an indictment, really, against Israel's selfishness and their self-indulgence. They were just typical, natural, carnal human beings. And they didn't want the sanctified nourishment that Yahweh had sent them, that Yahweh had provided. And he chose for themselves their own diet. And they got a lot more than they bargained for in the process. Verse 24, and Moses went out and told the people the words of Yahweh and gathered the 70 men, the elders of the people, and set them round about the tabernacle. So he calls his 70 assistants, and here they are, gathered around, receive the Holy Spirit. And verse 25, we find that those of the Spirit prophesied. And the Hebrew word is not teach, it actually means prophesied. To tell prophecy, foretell the future. And this is also what we find in Acts chapter 2 as well, when the Holy Spirit was given and men began to speak the wonderful works of Yahweh. So now we have a peculiar incident with a future counterpart. Yahshua, the future general who will ultimately succeed Moses one day, is afraid that two of these men that have the Spirit are kind of hanging around and they're busy prophesying in Moses, in his domain, you might say. And he wanted them stopped. And Moses' response says, shouldn't all men be able to do this? Isn't this a good thing? You know, we find the same thing in the book of Acts, don't we? Same thing. It mirrors Moses, who was a type of Yahshua, who said in Mark 9:39 that if someone does miraculous things like throw out a demon in his name, that person is on his side and shouldn't be stopped, as John had wrongly commanded it be done. But anyway, now we move on to chapter 12. So we have Moses now, and the leadership is now opening up. We've got Moses plus 70 others. And apparently then, his sister, especially, and his brother see an opening here. With an opening of the leadership, they want to share in the lead. We have Moses' position threatened by his very brother and sister. I don't understand this human desire for power all the time. But here they have it. Here they have a real problem. Chapter 12, verse 1, and Miriam and Moses spake against Moses because... I'm sorry, Miriam and Aaron spake against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married, for he had married an Ethiopian woman. They didn't like, apparently, Zipporah because of her, maybe, influence on Moses' life. She had some say, which means she was, you know, in a certain amount of power, too. Well, actually, she was a Cushite. She was an Arabian, not an Ethiopian. And probably, maybe because they, you know, scorned her, that they called her this name that's Ethiopian. But anyway, we find that Miriam is listed first, so she's first in the transgression, in this rebellion, because she was the prime instigator. And she is the one who really suffers from Yahweh's anger, as we're about to see. And although she is the first woman in the Bible to be called a prophetess in Exodus 15:20, it actually means that she was gifted in music, if you want to look that up. Gifted in music. Remember when she led, the women started singing after they got across the Red Sea there, and she led the women in a song. She's also a leader of the women in this regard, and therefore already a member of the government, you might say. In fact, in Micah 6:4, it lists Miriam, Aaron, and Moses as being sent to rescue Israel. So she already has a part, but apparently it's not enough. And this issue with Zipporah is reminiscent of Sarah's jealousy of Hagar. It's a jealousy thing. Chapter 12, verse 2. And they said, "Has Yahweh indeed spoken only by Moses? Has he not spoken also by us?" And Yahweh heard it. What does this rebellion sound like to you? Any other parallels you can think of? I think of Hasatan, the desire for power. Is he the only one? He tells Eve. The desire for power, it destroys governments, it destroys assemblies, it destroys relationships on every level. It arises from what? Pride. Pride, which is the root of sin itself. Satan says, "I will rise up and be like the Most High." He had that much pride in him, thinking he could take Yahweh's position. Notice this, though, in verse 3. "Now the man Moses was very meek above all the men which were upon the face of the earth." Very meek man, meaning humble. It also means depressed and afflicted. He was the most depressed and afflicted on the face of the earth. You think you have problems. Moses also had the patience of Job, and now he had to endure the accusations of his own sister and brother. Good night. Notice, though, he didn't resent the injury done to him, nor complain about it to Yahweh, nor make any appeal to Yahweh. But Yahweh, it says, resented what Miriam and Aaron were doing. You know, Yahweh hears all that's said against us or someone else, which I think we need to consider and watch our language sometimes, because Matthew 12:36 says, "Every idle word which man speak will one day they'll take account of in the day of judgment." Idle word. Something we say we didn't think too much about, and you think, "Oh, why did I say that?" You make an offhanded remark about somebody and then think, "Man, why did I say that? That was stupid of me." We've all said things that hurt, or that we shouldn't have said, and afterward look back and think, because words can also cut and hurt, and makes us look like the fool, like a bad disease. The best cure for loose lips is to avoid them in the beginning. Pause before you fire off a volley. Think about what you're going to say. I remember a person, I don't know if this is just their nature, but you would talk to them, and they wouldn't respond right away. There's a little pause there. And they were thinking about their response. And I kind of remember that when I read this. Think before you speak. Will it help? Will it hurt? What are the consequences? Most importantly, is this what a child of Yahweh should be saying? And what if we're on the receiving end of a nasty comment, like Moses here, all these accusations coming at him? In Psalm 38:13, David says of those who speak evil against him, he says, "I heard not, for you will hear." You're going to hear it, Yahweh. The more silent we are in our own cause, the more Yahweh will come to our defense. The accusation given will not go unpunished, perhaps, when Yahweh hears it. The accused, innocent person needs to say little if Yahweh's the judge. So the very power that Miriam and Aaron envied was devastating Moses at this point. It was more than ever they could ever imagine or hold on their shoulders, ever sustain. Neither of them was a Moses, and yet they thought they could be there. They thought they deserved to be there, right up on top. "Scoot over, Moses. We're going to sit right next to you." They thought they could do that. Over the years, there have been many rebellions that I've seen in different assemblies. Ultimately, some have gotten what they wanted. They pulled a certain group away, and they did all right, and all of a sudden, started falling apart. It worked for a short while, but they couldn't handle it. the work and trials that leadership sometimes bring was more than they could bear. They found out that leadership is 95% perspiration and 5% inspiration, not the other way around. It's not all what it's cracked up to be. And Moses found this out, and they were going to have to learn some important lessons too. So Yahweh in verse 4 speaks suddenly unto Moses and said unto Aaron and unto Miriam, come out, you three, into the tabernacle of the congregation. You know, take them all out. Can you imagine Yahweh saying, you, and you, come out. I want to talk to you. So this is what he did. And they came out, the three of them. And Yahweh came down the pillar of the cloud and stood in the door of the tabernacle. Now, Aaron was the high priest. He was, you know, used to having clear access to the tabernacle. Here we got Yahweh standing in his way. Whoa. And called Aaron and Miriam, and they both came forth. And he said, hear now my words. If there be a prophet among you, I, Yahweh, will make myself known unto him in a vision and will speak unto him in a dream. My servant Moses is not so, who is faithful in all my house. With him I will speak mouth to mouth. Yahweh communicated with this man directly. He didn't speak to him in dreams, in visions. He said, this is how close this man is to me. Get this in your heads. And the anger of Yahweh was kindled, verse 9, against them, and he departed. And the cloud departed from off the tabernacle, and behold, Miriam became leprous, white as snow. And Aaron looked upon her, and behold, she was leprous. And Aaron said unto Moses, alas, my master, I beseech you, lay not the sin upon us wherein we have done foolishly and wherein we have sinned. As much as they didn't like to recognize it, Moses had a special, unique calling and equipping from Yahweh. They didn't speak against Moses as the president of Israel as much as they spoke against Moses as a servant of Yahweh. And it wasn't that Moses was beyond criticism. Obviously, he made mistakes. Everybody does. And it wasn't like he was never confronted and asked the tough questions either. In fact, another relative of Moses, do you remember the incident with Jethro? Came to Moses and confronted him and made a suggestion, and Moses took him up on it. Let's turn to Exodus 18. Exodus 18, verse 12. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifice for Elohim. And Aaron came and all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses, the father-in-law, before Elohim. It came to pass on the morrow that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood by Moses from the morning until the evening. And when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did to the people, he said, what is this thing that you do to the people? Why sittest you yourself alone and all the people stand by from morning to evening? Imagine that's your job every day. Sit there and solve problems from morning till evening. Imagine that. Difficult problems with family, friends, whatever. And Moses said unto his father-in-law, because the people come to me, that's why I'm here. And when they have a matter, they come unto me, and I judge between one and the other, and I do make them know the statutes of Yahweh and his laws. Interesting, this is before Sinai. I make known to them his statutes and laws. I'm talking Exodus 18, 16. And Moses' father-in-law said unto him, the thing which you do is not good. You will surely wear away, both you and this people that is with you, for this thing is too heavy for you, and you're not able to perform it yourself alone. Hearken now unto my voice. I'll give you counsel, and Yahweh shall be with you. Be you for the people to Elohim, that you may bring the causes unto Elohim, and you shall teach them ordinances and laws, and show them the way wherein they must walk and the work that they must do. So he gives them some advice. You shall provide out of the people able men, such as fear Yahweh, and hate covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of the thousands and rulers of hundreds, rulers of 50s and rulers of tens, and then judge the people and so forth. So he did that. He brought in some help. So he wasn't perfect. He tried to do it all himself, found out he couldn't do it. No one could. Miriam and Aaron should have been afraid to speak against Moses because, for one thing, their criticism was petty and was over something which he had no control. The wife of Moses. Some things can't be changed. It's best left unsaid. Say, oh, well, let's move on. But they used it as a focal point, a rallying point for their criticism. It was prompted by their own self-interest. They were envious, and they wanted some of the power for themselves. And Yahweh judged swiftly. Aaron pleads that this punishment be removed. Aaron seems like a man easily swayed. Do you ever get that impression? Easily swayed. Kind of whatever the crowd wanted, he would willingly do. Make us an idol, he went ahead and did it. Swayed by his sister, who was, of course, the older of the family and the instigator. And now he swayed quickly back to a humble submission before Moses. Well, in that respect, it's good. Now, if Miriam was to receive such punishment, what about Israel? What were the Israelites to deserve? Well, they're punished too. Verse 15, the people removed from Hazeroth and pitched in the wilderness of Paran. They had to stay until she was healed. So in a way, they were punished. Many lessons here for the believer. I think the spiritual parallels of this chapter teach their own lesson. Moses, as the ordained leader, represents Yahshua the Messiah. Yahshua the Messiah, out there interceding for the people. He brings the people out of the sin of Egypt, just as Yahshua did, bringing his people out of sin. He destroyed the king of Egypt, which is representative of Satan. He's the one Yahweh works through to bring Israel through their rituals and trials and testings and leading them to Yahweh in the promised land, through obedience to his commands. So Moses is the type of Messiah. Miriam represents the assembly, which is what a woman typically represented in the scriptures. She suffers the punishment of leprosy, a corruption of the flesh. She is healed only through the power of Yahweh after the intercession of Yahshua, or Moses, by undergoing 7 days of cleansing. Seven being the number of spiritual perfection and completeness. And she's restored to health again. Aaron is the high priest. He represents the ministry. Specifically, in this case, apostate ministry. He listens to the people, gives them whatever they want, and preaches and does what they want, not what Yahweh wants to do. He and the assembly ultimately must confess their sin to Yahweh through Yahshua or Moses. Moses had a vision. He had foresight. He had the characteristics of a great leader. He saw the big picture. He could see above all the pettiness down here in the hinterlands. And it was this spiritually induced farsightedness that sustained him and kept him going when all the others in Israel, all they saw was desperation, futility. We can't do it. It won't work. It's not going to help. Nothing's going to do any good. Let us just go back to where we came from. Let's give it up. I'm reminded of the story of the brave conductor. Two railroad trains ran parallel with one another. One day the workmen were cutting a big tree down. The tree fell on one of the tracks. Enormous tree. Because the chain broke. A smaller train came by and just escaped it. The conductor knew that the express train was coming on the other track and was due and would soon be wrecked and many lives would be lost. He stopped his train, jumped off, ran ahead, waved his arms excitedly like a crazy man, like a maniac, making all these wild movements so extremely that those who saw him must have thought he was crazy. But it was enough to get the engineer and the other express train to heed the strange warning, shut off the engine, put on the brakes, and stop his train right in front of the great tree. As the conductor looked into the eyes of some of the grateful faces that he had saved, it didn't matter that he was thought a maniac. It didn't matter. Don't let it bother you because you may be considered different or odd when you follow Yahweh, because you call on his true name and keep his laws. Don't let it bother you. Someday, they will understand, and they'll look in your face and say, you were right. You were right. I was wrong. It's the foresight that Moses had. Look, all of this is going to pass, but one day we're going into the promised land. That's what he was saying. Now on to chapter 13. This is the account of Israel's initial probe into the promised land, and this really shows some powerful lessons about human nature. And Yahweh spake unto Moses, saying, send you men, that they may search the land of Canaan, which I give unto the children of Israel. Of every tribe, of their fathers, shall you send a man, every one a ruler among them. And Moses, by the commandment of Yahweh, sent them from the wilderness of Paran, all those men that were heads of the children of Israel. So here are the men, the 10 men that were sent into this this new land to scope it out. Interesting, we look at down to verse 16. These are the names of the men which Moses sent to spy out the land. And Moses called Oshea, the son of Nun, Yahshua. Interesting that it's tacked on to the end of this listing. Why does the Bible make a specific point to say that Moses called Oshea Yahshua? Well, it didn't escape Mr. Bollinger in his companion Bible, which notes that Yahshua is the Greek J-E-S-U-S. Well, that's what has been rendered anyway. Oshea means Savior, and with the Yah prefixed, it means he whom Yahweh will save, by whom Yahweh will save. So anyway, in verse 17, Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan and said unto them, get you up out of the way southward and go into the mountain and see the land, which what it's all about, and the people that dwell there, whether they be strong or weak, few or many, and what the land is that we will dwell in, whether it be good or bad, and what cities they be that dwell in, whether in tents or in strongholds, and what the land is, whether it be flat or lean, whether there be wooded regions there or not, and be you of good courage and bring of the fruit of the land. Now the time was the time of the first ripe grapes. Well, they found a beautiful land, wonderful land, could really produce. They found it was rich and produced wonderful crops and produce and hauled out grapes on a big old stick of wood. It was so heavy. They had to carry it with 2 men. Wonderful crops. Verse 25 said they checked it out for 40 days. 40 days is the number of testing. Came back with a glowing report of its richness. Oh man, milk and honey. You want to see a land. This is it. This is indeed the promised land. Of course, that's where they get the term, but it was wonderful. And they were thrilled with it. But there's a problem. There's a problem, Moses. The people in the land are invincible. Forget it. Can't do it. Worst case. Verse 28, nevertheless, the people be strong that dwell in the land, and the cities are walled, very great. Moreover, we saw the children of Anak there. Oh, that is the ultimate worst. Anak. There's no way. I mean, we were like grasshoppers in their sight. And they're giants, verse 33. Giants, the sons of Anak, which came out of the giants, and we were in their sight as grasshoppers, and so we were in their sight. People are invincible. Well, Caleb, verse 30, begs to disagree. He stilled the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and possess it, for we are well able to overcome it. We can take it. There's no way, they said. No way. Can't do it. Remember what we read? I think we read it. Verse 2. Yahweh said, send the men that they may search the land which I give unto the children of Israel. It's a promise. Yahweh was going to give them the land. What more do you need? Yahweh can do anything. Why didn't they believe him? No, we can't do it. Mm-mm. It's too much for us. Yahweh has given them this land. It shouldn't be an issue when he's on their side. You see, this is all purely about faith, isn't it? That's all it is. Do they have the faith? Chapter 14, verse 1. And all the congregation lifted up their voice and cried, and the people wept that night. Oh my, gloom and doom. And all the children of Israel murmured against Moses, against Aaron, and the whole congregation said unto them, would Elohim that we have died in the land of Egypt, or would Elohim that we had died in this wilderness, and wherefore has Yahweh brought us into this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and our children would be prey? Were it not better for us to return unto Egypt? More than that, look at verse 4. And they said one to another, let us make a captain and let us return to Egypt. They've had enough. They went from a negative report, you know, all these giants and all these people in there, and we can't, we're much stronger than us, there's no way. They went from that to crying all night. You know how you build yourself into a frenzy of despair? Crying all night, deciding now to choose a leader to take them back home, back to Egypt. That's the power of negativism. And it'll do it. You can keep on dwelling on it till pretty soon you're ready to just chuck the whole thing. It's amazing how people can look at things. A shoe salesman was once sent to a far distant remote part of the country. When he arrived, he was dismayed because everyone there went around barefooted. So he wired the company. No prospect at all for sales. People don't wear shoes here. Later, another salesman went to the same territory. He too immediately sent word back to the company, the home office. But his message read, great potential! People don't wear shoes here. Winston Churchill said, a pessimist sees the difficulty in every opportunity. An optimist sees the opportunity in every difficulty. They had a great opportunity here. Go into this land. Wonderful opportunity to take a land that's rich in everything. And all they could see was the obstacles. You know, a believer never gets strong in the faith if his faith is never tried and he's never overcome these obstacles. When we have personal trials and tests, that's when we grow. We reassess ourselves, we look at ourselves and think, you know what, I got to change, and it's time. It's come to that. I've got to do something. And that's the perfect opportunity when we grow. That's when we grow. Times like this. Verse 6. This is how resolute they were. They wanted to go back. Moses and Aaron, they fell on their faces before the assembly. And Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, which were of them that searched the land, rent their clothes. They just couldn't believe their ears. And they spake unto the company of the children of Israel, saying, the land which we pass through to search is an exceeding good land. If Yahweh delight in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land that flows with milk and honey. Yahweh's behind it, brethren, he's saying. Only rebel not against Yahweh, neither fear us the people of the land, for they are bread for us. Their defense is departed from them, and Yahweh is with us. Fear them not. But all the congregation, what do they want to do? Stone the messenger. Stone them with stones. Kill them. They didn't even want to hear a good report. Then verse 22, because all these men which have seen my glory and my miracles, which I did in Egypt and now in the wilderness, and have tempted me now these 10 times, and have not hearkened to my voice, surely they shall not see the land which I swear unto their fathers, neither shall they them that provoked me see it. How many proofs did they need? Think about this. Just think about it. I mean, it's amazing. First of all, they had the dividing of the Red Sea, the destruction of Pharaoh's army. They sat and watched this happen. They saw the waters part and the come back, and his army completely inundated and drowned. Then in Exodus 15, Moses made the bitter water sweet at Marah, because the water, they needed drinking water, and he threw in some wood and made it sweet. Then they were hungry. Yahweh gives them what? Miraculously, out of the sky or whatever. In the morning, they come out and here's pie crust all over. Good tasting pie crust. The manna. Exodus 16, verse 2. Then in the same chapter, we have the fulfilling of the command to not let the manna sit or it's going to rot. Well, they didn't do that. And just as Yahweh said, it came about. Then in Exodus 17, they were thirsty again. Yahweh makes water come out of a rock. Moses, with his staff, creates this water come right out of a rock. Then in Exodus 32, we have the Ten Commandments, the lesson of the golden calf. And what did they learn from that? Then we have Numbers 11, the plague of the fire because of their complaining, which we read. Then we had, they wanted meat, so he gives them quail, miraculously. And now here at Kadesh, we have more proofs. These miracles don't even take into account what it took to get them out of Egypt and the 10 plagues, ultimately ending in Passover. They didn't even count that. How? I have a short memory, but man, you know, it took faith. It took faith. And they didn't have it. It was this kind of faith that was lacking, and it lacks in most people. I'll guarantee you take a group of people today, just go out here and grab a bunch of people and put them in the same situation, you're going to have the same reactions because they lack faith. Yahweh has called us out in a similar way and given us promises peculiar to his saints. Do we have the faith to continue on no matter what? No matter what trials we have. A lack of faith led to their lack of bravery. It reduced them to predictable, just weak people that can't seem to do anything but go back home. Weak. No bravery. No fortitude to do anything. Centuries ago, during one of the most turbulent of the desert wars in the Middle East, a spy was captured and sentenced to death by a general of the Persian army. Well, this general was compassionate as well, very intelligent man, and he adopted a strange and unusual custom in such cases. He permitted the condemned man to make a choice. The prisoner could either face a firing squad or go through the black door. As the moment of the execution drew near, the general ordered the spy to be brought in for a short interview, mainly to get his answer. What do you want? You want the firing squad or you want the black door? Well, this was a troubling decision, and the prisoner hesitated, but soon he made it known that he'd much prefer the firing squad to the unknown horrors that might await him before that ominous, mysterious black door. Not long thereafter, a volley of shots in the courtyard announced that the grim sentence had been carried out. The general, staring at his boots, turned to his aide and said, "You see how it is with men? They will always prefer the known to the unknown. People fear the unfamiliar. Still, I gave him a choice." "What lies behind the black door?" asked the aide. "Freedom," replied the general, "and I've only known a few brave men to take it." Israel could not know the outcome of the battles they would have had to take to get into the promised land, to overcome those people of Canaan. All they really had to do was go on the promise of Yahweh. That's all they had to do, is to accept Yahweh's promise that they could do it. I mean, he had proved himself how many times before? 20-plus miracles weren't enough. Destroying the Egyptian army wasn't even enough. And here they're worried about all these people in the promised land. From the time they left Egypt, it all boiled down to a lack of faith. They just didn't have the faith. Well, let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians 10, why should we study the book of Numbers? Why should we look at Israel and their trials in the wilderness? Well, for a very good reason, because we're commanded to. 1 Corinthians 10:1, "Moreover, brethren," Paul writes, "I would not that you should be ignorant how that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and did all eat the same spiritual meat, and did all drink the same spiritual drink. And they drank of that spiritual rock that followed, and that rock was Messiah. But with many of them Yahweh was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now, these things were our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Neither be ye idolaters, as some of them were, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Of course, this was the golden image. Neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed, and fell in one day 23,000. Imagine losing 23,000 people in one shot. Again, can we trust Yahweh? Is he going to take us out here into the wilderness and just allow us to die after doing all these things? Neither let us tempt Messiah, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed of serpents. Interesting that word there. The texts read the L-O-R-D, so I think that's a mistranslation. They tempted Yahweh, and some of them also were tempted, destroyed of serpents. Neither murmur you, as some of them also murmured, and were destroyed of the destroyer. Again, verse 11, now all these things happened unto them for examples. And they are written for our admonition, who is us, upon whom the ends of the world are come. I think it's appropriate we read, especially when we see of world events happening right now with the troubles in the Middle East. These things should be a wake-up call. The lessons are for us, no matter what may come in the future, when we ourselves might be drawn out into the wilderness. Will we have the faith to remain strong in Yahweh, or we want to turn back into destruction, as would have happened had they gone back to Egypt, no doubt. Lessons very valuable and important for a true believer. I think it's good to go back and see how the Bible harmonizes, and the truths are there for all of us. If we would just dig them out and look at how Yahweh worked in the past, how he works today. Same Yahweh, I change not, he says, and may Yahweh bless you.